Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the news, but who aren't necessarily politics know-it-alls. The world has far too many of those already, frankly. And if you want just someone to strip it all back and make sense of it for you on reasonably digestible terms, then this is your podcast. I'm Julia Bell, and today I am carrying on this little mini-series where I explore what the last 18 months has been like for people in countries whose governments have handled the pandemic entirely differently to ours here in the UK. So first of all, I chatted to Romy in Japan, who shared her concerns about the government's refusal to issue a formal lockdown, and of course about how the Olympics, which are set to be hosted in Tokyo in a matter of weeks, still seem very much to be going ahead despite a hefty majority of the Japanese public willing it to be cancelled. So that was a really insightful chat. And then I spoke to Per in Sweden, another country who have not done a proper lockdown at all. But frankly, he seemed a lot more chilled out about that. Even while, you know, COVID cases and COVID deaths are far worse in Sweden than they have been in its neighbouring Scandi countries. But he kind of focused on mental health and kids being able to go to school and all the rest of it. So that was really insightful too. I've kind of found with these conversations, it's interesting how much the culture and the mood of a country has actually played into how their governments have decided to deal with COVID. You'd think there would just be kind of one correct stock response to this pandemic. And the more you explore other countries, the more you realise that's not the case. And it also kind of gives you an insight into our culture and how the government have handled that with our culture in mind, if you know what I mean. Anyway, carrying on the trend, I wanted to reach out to somebody in New Zealand. This is a country that has been praised worldwide for its decisive and effective handling of the pandemic. I checked up on their numbers and just compared to almost everywhere else, they're so low. So throughout this entire process, since the pandemic began, New Zealand have had a total of 2,679 known COVID cases and 26 COVID-related deaths. 26 throughout this whole process. Compare that to the UK and our 4.5 million known COVID cases and 128,000 deaths. It's totally unsurprising that a lot of people here put the leader of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, on the mother of all pedestals. I know there's different variables. New Zealand is much more isolated than we are, much less densely populated, but it's completely undeniable. A large chunk of their success does come down to government policy. That is just facts. Her decisions will have had a direct result in how this went in New Zealand. Ardern is, I talk about her quite a lot on the podcast, I feel like. She's just a character who deeply interests me. She's 40 years old. She was 37 when she was first elected Prime Minister of New Zealand in 2017. She's the leader of the New Zealand Labour Party. And initially, when she was elected in 2017, she had a minority government, which listeners in the UK will be overly familiar with because we've dealt with our fair share of those. Theresa May in 2017, the same year, had to team up with the DUP, famously, giving them £1 billion to make a deal and help her govern, because you can't really do it with a minority. Jacinda Ardern had the same issue in 2017. She had to team up with the New Zealand Green Party. That's how she came to govern first off. But in 2020, New Zealand has had a general election again where the Labour Party, Jacinda Ardern's party, won with a landslide.
New Zealand has shown the Labour Party its greatest support in at least 50 years. In seats we may have hoped for, but in those equally we may not have expected. And for that, I only have two simple words. Thank you.
That was Ardern's election victory speech in October 2020. Definitely the thing that pushed her up onto the kind of global radar, or maybe that's just my opinion, let's say my personal radar, but I think a lot of people were the same, was Jacinda Ardern's response to the mosque shooting that happened in Christchurch in March 2019. More than 50 people were shot dead, and about the same amount were seriously injured in two different mosque shootings. And Jacinda Ardern's response, she went pretty much straight to Christchurch to meet the families of the victims. She swore never to use the shooter's name. And then less than a month after the attack itself, her government wrote and passed and implemented a law that basically got rid of semi-automatic weapons and assault rifles from the New Zealand market. So she basically said, this is a weakness, we just don't need this, get rid. Compassionate, swift, decisive. Global praise for that response.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless. And to others, I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost rather than the name of the man who took them.
So that was her addressing her peers in March 2019, famously refusing to use the killer's name, refusing to sort of pander to the terrorist, as she called him, the terrorist's wish for notoriety. And then just to add that response to the pandemic, you know, she's been hailed as one of the strongest leaders, who just happens to be a relatively young female, that the whole planet has to offer. But the question is the feeling the same on the ground in New Zealand? It's all well and good us saying that, because comparatively, you can't help but feel that she is a really good leader if you look at how the last year has gone for us. But would a New Zealander agree? They don't necessarily care about comparing her. They just want the best for them. So I was really interested to find that out. And the only way to do that is to chat to one. So to line somebody up in New Zealand, again, my network kind of reached its limit when it came to people who were willing to sit down and talk to me for half an hour about this. So I asked my dad to reach out to his old friend, Sean, who they used to be kind of best buddies and colleagues when Sean lived here in the UK. But he moved to New Zealand, much to my dad's despair, about 8 or 9 years ago, I think it was. And I made my dad do the awkward thing and say to Sean, look, Julia wants to speak to somebody in New Zealand, preferably not you, because you're not born and bred Kiwi. So you're not a born and bred New Zealander. She kind of wants to speak to somebody who's even more embroiled in the culture than you, which I know put my dad in a bit of an awkward position, but he did do it, bless him. And Sean, the legend that he is, hooked me up with his friend Leon, who also turned out to be an absolute gem. So here is how that conversation went.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, yourself?
Yeah, good. Thanks for doing this. I realise it's quite random.
It's very random, but mind you, Sean's a very random guy sometimes.
So listen, I'm just kind of putting together like a little round the world with COVID-19, talking to people and just trying to get their personal experiences. And I think people in the UK are particularly interested about how New Zealanders actually feel, because the case study is you guys handled it perfectly, but actually maybe it's different on the ground. So I think people will be quite excited to hear.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation, because I suppose we, over here, we don't really know what it's like other than seeing what the media sort of hypes it up to be in all the other countries, whereas we really haven't experienced it at that level. So it's kind of foreign.
Is it quite surreal that it's kind of still affecting everyone else so profoundly?
Yeah, life is more or less back to normal. You know, there's the odd thing that, you know, public transport with masks is still a thing, but you know, it's not a biggie.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Well, take me back then to the start of the pandemic in New Zealand. So it's spring 2020. Jacinda Ardern has just announced this kind of unprecedented lockdown, despite there actually being very few cases of COVID-19 in the country. How popular was that move? Because you didn't have the power of hindsight at the time. Did it feel like an overreaction? Were people pissed off about it, or did they go along with it for the most part?
I think, in general, New Zealand is a pretty sort of agreeable type people. They were seeing all the what was happening overseas, and the media we get is mainly overseas sort of media about what was happening in China and then Italy, for instance, what was happening there. So we're most, I think, were saying, okay, fair enough. We kind of saw it coming. They were leading us up to it. We had one case maybe a couple of weeks beforehand, and they're like, right, anyone who's coming into the country's got to lock down for self-quarantine for 14 days. So they were doing all these regular press conferences to keep New Zealand up to date. It was like, I think it was like 1 p.m. and or 3 p.m. type conference calls, and they were giving the New Zealand public all the information throughout the lead up to the lockdown. So everyone was kind of prepared. And then I think it was the Monday beforehand, Jacinda came out with the health professionals, said, right, we're going into a hard lockdown, level 4, the whole country, and it'll be, 4 weeks type thing. So, and they extended it a little bit from there. So, and everyone was like, oh, okay.
Do you remember how long it was overall that you were in lockdown across the country?
We're like 25th of March. I remember the start date because it was my dad's birthday. And then we came out 27th of April. So wow. Down to level 3, it was like, that was level 4. Then level 3 was 27th of April, and you were allowed to sort of go out and pick up takeaways or go, go to the supermarkets a little bit more freely. And then we sort of dropped back down to level 2 by May 13th. So that was almost back to normal. For work-wise, we were back sort of split shifts, half a week at work, half a week at home, and everyone sort of just more or less got back to normal. So
did the government offer financial support, even though it was such a short time?
They did. It was actually a huge move, and I worked in finance, so they were giving all the business customers a lot of relief options there. It was absolutely crazy at the time. So we're making calls to all our customers about they gave business guarantee loans, like the government were going to guarantee loans 80%, up to 80%, and then they extended it further, the amount that businesses could borrow, and then they did interest-free loans through our tax department, our Inland Revenue Department. So they gave that to businesses, the wage subsidy, pretty much all businesses qualified. It wasn't too many that didn't, because the qualifying criteria as well, are you going to lose revenue compared to this time last year? And everyone was like, well, we're not working for 4 weeks. Yes. So most businesses got the wage subsidy. Some paid it back because they came out a lot stronger. So.
And it was only 4 weeks.
4 or 5 weeks, yeah.
Yeah. Can you feel the long-term effect of a pandemic? Because, for example, here in the UK, job losses, restaurants and bars that can't really open their doors again, the strain on the public's mental health, the fact that kids haven't been basically to school for the best part of a year, you can see physical evidence of the toll that that's taken on the country when you walk down the street. Is there anything like that in New Zealand?
In pockets, yeah. And New Zealand's hugely into tourism. We rely a lot on tourism, especially down the likes of Rotorua and Queenstown. They've been impacted greatly. I think Auckland, our main Queen Street, suffered a lot. There's been a lot of businesses that have shut down. But it's not in-your-face type stuff unless you live and breathe in those industries. Like the tourism guys, they've had to cut right back on staff and what they can do. But in saying that, when we came out of lockdown, it's like everyone was keen to go and do something and support the local tourism and businesses that they came out of. So it was, they had a little bit of a bump after that, after all that pent-up demand. But they're still hurting. We've just opened up our Trans-Tasman bubble with Australia, so that's starting to work both ways.
So basically, you go on holiday to Australia or New Zealand?
Yeah, and the Cook Islands also come online shortly, later this month, I think, as a Cook Islands bubble as well. So
it's my dream. It is my dream to go. Sometimes, this is a true story, sometimes when I'm depressed, I go onto Google Maps, I zoom into the Cook Islands, and then I go on Street View.
Oh, yes.
And then I look around as if I'm there. That's how rubbish it's been in the UK. I have genuinely done that multiple
times. That's your virtual holiday now, is it?
Yes.
A lot of New Zealanders go to holidays in Aussie, like to the Gold Coast is like, everyone seems to go there to escape a bit of winter because it's still sort of mid-20 degrees. So everyone goes over there. So that's sort of coming back at the right time. And then the Aussies come here for the ski season. So that's probably the timing's about right, provided they can manage it right, but they seem to be. So
that's great. And the thing is, though, you're in one way, it's a positive that you are quite isolated, because for COVID-19, it's been a blessing. But when it comes to travel, it's going to be a while before a Kiwi gets to go on holiday to Europe, I feel. Maybe even years.
Yeah. Well, they're talking, some people are saying 2024 before full international travel. And you're like, wow, that's
that
huge,
is
isn't
crazy.
It?
Here, Boris Johnson, actually the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, has announced a green list of countries that we're allowed to go to on holiday, and New Zealand is on it.
as if
New Zealand is going to let us go. So it's like, why are you allowing this when Jacinda Ardern will categorically turn us away? It's so audacious.
Yeah, but you guys have got quite a way through all your vaccinations as well, which we haven't really even started. So
I was going to ask, how's the vaccine program going? Are you vaccinated?
No, not yet. It's only been rolled out to the frontline staff, like within the last couple of weeks or so. So like you're talking to your border workers and the hospital workers, and they're about to do it to the over 65s and so forth. And yeah, so
you're really early stages.
Yeah, we're really early stages. But I mean, you kind of understand it, because we haven't been hit as hard. So you're like, you know, there's not a massive urgency unless the borders are well open, which they're not. So
yeah. What is the public's perception to the vaccine? Because here, that there are pockets of people who are essentially anti-vax and don't trust it, but majoritarily it's pretty good. What about there?
I suppose you'll have your pockets as well. It's a little bit of an unknown, because every year everyone gets the flu shot. Now, we're such a small population. When we talk about small pockets, it's really small pockets compared to, I suppose, the likes of the UK or the US.
Do you feel like, if there was an election tomorrow, I know you've actually had one quite recently, haven't you?
Yeah, we had one in October last year, and basically the way that Jacinda and her government handled it actually did them a lot of favours, because they actually won by a landslide. And under our MMP system, they're the first government to be able to rule on their own as a majority.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, under that system. So that's only been going since 1996, where they have a mixed member parliament, whatever they call it, MMP. So yeah, they won a mandate to basically rule on their own without having to have another minor party to support them.
Wow. And you think that is because of the pandemic? And if it weren't for that, you'd probably be...
Yeah, 100%. I mean, they basically Jacinda had daily coverage. So she was in everyone's mind, and she handled it really well. I mean, could she have done things better? Yeah. But there was no real blueprint on how to handle these things, I suppose. And they were learning as they go. And in large, I think the opposition agreed with a lot of what they were doing. The arguments came on how they handled the economy, more so than how they handled the health response. There was the odd leak and border breaches and people getting out of the MIQ facilities and that, which, you know, the opposition for opposition's sake had to raise those issues, so they tightened it. But
was she popular before the pandemic, or was there mixed views?
Yeah, she was. I mean, that was when she first got in, there was what they called Jacinda mania, because she was new, fresh, young, so just different than the old stuffy normal old politicians you have that have sort of rolled through. So that got her in, because Labor over here was really struggling before she got elevated to the leader. Mm-hmm. And it just gave them basically a big facelift. And yeah.
And are people still social distancing, wearing masks? Is there, like, when you walk out the door, do you remember that there's a pandemic?
Not really, unless you go past a bus.
Right.
Because that's where everyone's wearing masks. So normally you'll go, there's all the scanning, everyone's sort of scanning, and the odd person, I suppose, will be social distancing. But in large, not really. You don't really notice it. You can go to the pub, you go to the shops, shop as normal. There's crowds of people. My daughter, 17-year-old daughter, went with her friends to a concert at Eden Park. What was it, last weekend or weekend before? It's like 50,000 people there.
I would die to go clubbing. I want to go clubbing. I want to be around randoms. I can't, these days, you can't meet new people. I haven't met somebody new in a year. because you can only meet people that you've organised to meet.
We had that to a certain degree. They restricted us, I think it was to 10 at some stage after we came out, but it wasn't for too long. They restricted weddings up to 100 and weddings and funerals up to 100 and something along those lines, but that didn't last long. I went to a wedding a couple of months ago in another little city, and there was probably over 100 people there, and no one was fazed by it all. So, wow. Yeah.
Has there been much coverage in New Zealand of how things have been unfolding in the UK specifically?
Yeah, we get a lot. We get a lot of the US, UK media, probably because it's such a big global event and there's nothing to report on it here. So
yeah,
they're still covering what's happening overseas because, yeah, there's not much event-wise happening here. If it'll make the main news if one person gets COVID who came in through the border for here, and you're like, that's not really big news. Yeah. When you've got things that are happening over in India and you go, well, okay, that's news.
Yeah.
Like you said, we're so isolated. We're down the bottom end of the earth. We're not even on some maps. So some people don't even know where we are. So.
Really?
Yeah, there is some shit. Maps. Yeah.
That's a real shame.
We're okay with that sometimes.
Right.
I mean, we get noticed for like some of the movies like The Lord of the Rings and having Middle Earth down here. That brings in a lot of tourists and so forth along those lines.
You're on Tolkien's map of Middle Earth and you're not on the real Earth map. That's great.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's quite funny because people in the States sometimes you see some interviews because New Zealand get quite, you know, they like the humour of seeing why people know we're New Zealanders and they think it's part of Australia.
I mean, it's not even that near Australia in miles, is it? How far is it? Do you know?
Oh, it's about, from Auckland, it's about a three and a half hour journey to the east coast of Australia. So
by flight.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not close.
I mean, this is the thing. I think this is why people are struggling here because you can swim to France. So people are just used to having access to other cultures and other weather systems instantly, very cheaply, and you can get a train to the Netherlands, you can get a train to Switzerland. Like we just are an island that's so well connected, and we've got kind of the best of all those worlds, and it's just been ripped away from us indefinitely. And you know, the government have announced this green list of countries, and it's like you can go to Israel. It's so random. You can go to Israel, you can go to New Zealand, you can go to the Falklands. I don't even know how you'd get there.
You can't even get to France or anything yet or anything like that.
We're not allowed to go there, no.
No?
No.
You can go to Ireland?
No.
No?
It's just so, nobody quite understands the rationale behind it. Well, listen, I think I've asked you everything that I wanted to ask you.
I hope it gets back to somewhat normal for you guys soon because we're in a pretty privileged position at the moment, and it's you know, yeah. So that's what I think helps the government. It's like, okay, you did a good job because it's happening again. It's happening again. We're allowed to now travel to Australia. We're going to be able to travel to the Cook Islands. And we go to sports matches. We have been for ages. So it's just normal.
It's a lottery that you guys were there. We're here, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think, actually, one thing I didn't ask you is, do you think that New Zealand's culture had something to do with how well it handled the pandemic? Do you think as a culture, you're quite kind of obedient? So when the government said we're doing this, people just did it.
I think we are. Yeah. New Zealand, like, yeah, okay. You know, all right. If someone says do that, okay. Makes sense. We'll roll along. I mean, they call us. The Aussies always joke us and say we're 5 million sheep over here. So maybe we are. But it's worked out for us, I suppose. So.
Well, listen, I'll let you get back to your evening. Thank you again.
No worries. You take it easy. All right.
You too. So that was Leon in Auckland, New Zealand, who kindly took time out of his evening, and it was my first thing in the morning, to chat to me, a total stranger who was asking him lots of personal questions. So it was very kind. And it was interesting. He touched on this travel corridor that's been set up between New Zealand and Australia, where citizens of each can visit the other exclusively without having to quarantine. So that's the beauty of this, and that's what's essentially bolstering the travel and tourism industries between the two countries. That's how they're sort of trying to keep those airlines and hotel chains and all the rest of it afloat. But that travel corridor has been sort of wrapped up in a political controversy between the two nations. There is distinct tension between Australia and New Zealand. And it can't, I think a lot of it is rooted in the fact that Australia has this very harsh policy where anyone who isn't Australian, so isn't an Australian citizen, who is convicted of a crime resulting in up to 12 months in prison, 12 months in prison or over, they don't get to stay in Australia. They just get their visa stripped away and they get deported. So if you get convicted of a crime and, you know, your sentence is 15 months in prison, you're out. You're booted out on a plane. Off you go, never to return. So it's kind of a not our people, not our problem kind of mentality. But that policy is even used for people who have lived in Australia for longer than they've lived in New Zealand. So take Taran O'Dowd, who is kind of a famous example of this policy just seeming incredibly harsh. 41-year-old mother of two. She'd lived in Australia for 32 years. So a hefty majority of her life. She was convicted of drug possession, sentenced to 18 months, deported, visa stripped, done. You're not seen as an Australian, you're seen as a burden on our system, and out you go. But the big controversy came, I mean, that policy is controversial enough, just sending people back to New Zealand who haven't lived there in decades. But the kind of the worst part of this political sort of shitstorm was when the Australian Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, described this really harsh migration policy as, quote, taking out the trash.
Well, it's taking the trash out, then we can make Australia a safer place.
So that's Peter Dutton's voice there. And you can imagine, you know, New Zealand looking at this on their side, they're thinking, hang on, so if a Kiwi, that's a name for a New Zealander, if a Kiwi moves to Australia, lives there for 30 years, contributes more to your community and your economy than they do here, really, we would see that person as an Australian citizen rather than a New Zealander. But you're just going to kick them over here whenever they do anything wrong. And 12 months prison sentence, you know, it's not like if someone's convicted for a 20-year prison sentence and they're deported. 12 months, that's the threshold. And when Australia deported a 15-year-old boy, so a minor, to New Zealand, amongst a whole host of other deportees, literally hundreds over the past year alone, that has sparked yet more outrage amongst New Zealanders. In fact, New Zealand's foreign minister, Nania Mahuta, there's this clip of her speaking to the press. She bit back directly at Peter Dutton, saying, look, him calling this scheme taking the trash out, quote, only serves to trash his own reputation. Oh, so there's key leaders in both countries that are kind of lashing out at each other in a way. And that is a really difficult dynamic for Ardern to compete with. So she describes herself as a progressive politician. She's voiced that, look, Australia has its own laws. It's entitled to implement whatever policies it wants. But just for the record, New Zealand happens to strongly oppose this one. And yeah, it's just the dynamic. So she's having to maintain relationships with, well, the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who, of course, is in charge and therefore supports these Australian policies. And incidentally, he's been on a visit, a state visit to New Zealand this week to have formal talks with Ardern. And it was all smiles. They were hugging and doing the kind of traditional greeting. You might have seen it where they sort of place their foreheads together. No masks, which was kind of iconic to show that they're out the other end of this pandemic. So it was a very joyous looking occasion, but it was very clear that the two have very clashing views in many ways. Morrison, the Australian PM, fundamentally more right-wing than her. That's just the easiest way to explain it. So, that yes, they've got this exclusive relationship, but actually quite contradictory political stances on things. And I mean, this Dutton guy, the Aussie Minister for Defence, he vocally opposes same-sex marriage. So I imagine putting him next to Ardern, who is this outwardly progressive politician, would be like pouring red wine into your cereal. It's that contradictory. But yeah, what do you reckon? Is Ardern the leader we all want? Does she deserve this global pedestal that she's been put on by kind of liberals and progressives? Or are you perfectly happy with our leadership? Do you feel like the variables are too different to compare how she's handled COVID and how Boris Johnson has? Get in touch with me on social media at JuliaBell_X. Don't forget, you can send your questions in that can prompt whole episodes. If you want to know something specific and I feel like, yeah, that would make a really good podcast, do get in touch, because that has happened before. And listen, I say it every time, but if you like these episodes and you find them helpful and kind of different enough from all the other news commentary out there, the only way to keep me going, the only way to keep this happening, is to become a Patreon. If you've been thinking about this for some time, you've not quite got round to just biting the bullet, please can I ask that you go ahead and do that today. And there's loads of exclusive content on there for you, so it is well worth it. Oh yeah, also, before I go, I have to mention that Bare Naked Politics got nominated for a British Podcast Award. Cannot believe. I was llama trekking, true story, llama trekking with my parents for my dad's 60th birthday, one of the most berserk days of my life. And then I knew that the nominees were coming out that day. So I was kind of checking my phone intermittently, but I didn't tell my parents that the nominees were coming out that day, because I didn't want them to be like thinking about that when they should have been thinking about the llama day. But yeah, got the email through and saw that I initially saw that the nominees for current affairs and news, which I was not part of that list, I was like, okay, didn't get nominated, not really surprised, because I literally do this podcast on my own. And they are much bigger, kind of more established productions. Fine, very good. Put my phone back in my pocket. And then the llama trek stopped for like a coffee. It was really cute, actually. They set up this little coffee station and we all sat with our llamas. It was so weird. And I thought, you know what? I'll check all the other categories and see if there's any other podcasts that I know that have been nominated. And so I scrolled down through the list and I saw that Bare Naked Politics got nominated for a Bullseye Award, which is kind of like a newcomer award, or an award for like people who are creating content that doesn't really fit into any of the other categories, but it provides like a great listening experience, I think was how they put it. So it's kind of for like a smaller scale production, and that's exactly what I am. I do this thing all on my own. I do it for the love of it, and it genuinely wouldn't be possible me getting nominated without you guys letting me know what you want me to talk about and listening in every week. So thank you, because I wouldn't keep making these if you weren't listening. And I'll let you know how the awards show goes. It's on the 10th of July. I have very, very few hopes that I will win anything, because I've listened to my competition, if you will. I've listened to the other nominees and they are really, really good, as they should be. They've been nominated for an award. So I might, you know what, I should get some of them or all of them on the podcast. Do you know what? That's what I'll do. I'll reach out to them and see if they're into coming on here and introducing you to their podcast, because they are great. And that might be quite nice. So yes, thank you for letting me boast there. Have the best week. If you're in the UK, I hope you're enjoying that sunshine. I'm going to be trying to edit this in the sun, because I need to spend as much time in it as possible, since I'm probably not going to be going away this year, thanks to that infinitesimally small green travel list that they've announced. And I will be back with another episode soon, I'm very sure. Okay, have a good day. Goodbye.